Okay, we'll go ahead and call Dr. Ory.
Almost, Mr. Chairman, one more question. I'm just trying to get a relationship between the $30 million in facilities and this $1 million a year tax, property tax, as Taylor just said. Then you've got one mill would bring in $30,000. So they've got about $1 million a year. I guess they must have about a 30 mil property tax.
No, it's an 11 mil tax, but the $1 million in taxes is taxes on land and the facility. And in that case, we bought 1,500 acres of land so that we'd have a buffer zone around our facility so we wouldn't have any impact, air quality or water quality or any impacts like that. So we've got 1,500 acres of land and a 15-acre site. So we're only using about 1% of the land, but we're paying taxes on the land, too.
Well, you mean $30 million facility does not include that land you're talking about?
It includes the tax on the land.
No, but the $30 million you mentioned.
No, the $30 million does not include the value of the land.
So they've got about 11 mil tax.
They've got 11 mil tax on
more than $30 million.
Yeah.
$30 million facility plus 1,500 acres.
Well, and then whatever the land tax is, and I forget the numbers, you know, but it's...
Mr. Field? Mr. Parrish, he's indicated that he's finished.
We have no more questions.
All right, well, I'll let some of the other committee members have get their questions if they have some. Mike?
Do we know what percentage of federal land will be utilized by oil companies for their onshore development at the Yakutat, for instance? There's very little state land available.
I don't know, Mike. I don't have any idea what.
We were down there in October for coastal zone management. We were talking to the mayor. They indicated they were putting up an industrial park and making an area on the waterfront available.
I don't know anything about anybody's plans for onshore sites. I do know from my Santa Barbara experience, for instance, that for what you're talking about, and that's basically separating oil, water, and gas, that it takes very little land, you know, for the onshore processing of offshore oil. If you're building platforms or building refineries or, you know, something like that, then it takes a lot of land or a lot more land. But basically the onshore processing for the oil is just a very minor thing. It's like the tank battery in an oil field and just doesn't amount to much. My example, we're using 15 acres of land, you know. And if Santa Barbara had an industrial park, that's probably where we would have been. They didn't happen to have one, so we kind of made our own buffer zone so we wouldn't impact anybody, and we're going to keep the rest of it in agriculture. And actually, it's a pretty good way to preserve open space because nothing will happen to that other 1,500 acres during our 20, 30-year production life, and then we go away, and you've got one parcel of 1,500 acres of land that's been preserved.
Mr. Hackney?
Is it practical to do that separation process on the platforms?
You can do some separating on the platform, and depending on how much water you have and how hard it is to separate the water from the oil. But then once you get it separated, then you've got this oil that you've got to do something with. And transporting it from the platform is a bigger problem. You know, you've got to have a marine terminal someplace.
What I'm thinking is if it's possible to separate it to a point where what you're transporting is pure oil.
Mostly not. It's not very it takes a fair amount of space to really get the oil and water separated. Now a typical platform, I have to relate back to the Santa Barbara because that's mostly where I've worked in that, but there we are doing some separation of oil and water on the platform, and we'll get the water content in the oil down to about 20%. Even at the period of time when we're producing 50 or 60% water. But to get below that on the platform would have taken a lot more space than we had available on the platform. And it depends on the oil field. You know, in some cases it might be practical.
So you really wouldn't have any way of knowing until the exploratory phase that this was finished and...
I guess I don't know the reason for your question, because it's a lot easier to do something on land than to build a platform to do it on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the space availability is easier on land.
A lot less impact on land if anything can be done.
Now, you can do the whole thing offshore, which is what we're going to do if we don't eventually get the approvals onshore. We're going to convert a tanker to an offshore production facility and moor it out in federal waters and separate the oil and water and send the water back to the platform and then offload our oil with alongside mooring of shuttle tankers and do the whole thing offshore, except that we'll lose all the natural gas because there's no way you can process natural gas offshore. But you can do the oil and water offshore. In our case, we can't do it on the platform. We do it on a separate vessel.
I see. That
same
was,
same idea.
That was really
okay.
What I was driving at.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't.
It's possible to
slow
do
on the
something
update.
Like that without having an impact on a shore facility.
Yeah.
By using it.
Sure.
Have there been cases where oil companies have cooperated in using a facility like that that's offshore?
Well, nearly always. These days, in any development onshore or offshore, the federal government, for one thing, usually encourages at least unitization so that you don't have a proliferation of facilities. I mean, if several companies get acreage in a certain area and find a field, the high likelihood is that each oil field, some one way or the other, would be unitized so that only one company operates. So that you know you don't have this duplication of facilities. That is our case in our deal in Santa Barbara. It's not really Exxon; we're the operator, but we've got three companies in the unit, and we've unitized 85,000 acres of land into one unit,
what
and we'll
happens,
do it with one facility.
What happens with the natural gas in a case like that if you can't flare it? Reinject it.
We'll be reinjecting it into the reservoir.
Which really isn't a bad deal because
yeah, it is.
Cost isn't too
high. Well, the bad deal is that when you re-inject gas into an oil reservoir, you're bound to lose part of it. You will presumably at some future time be able to recover part of it, but you won't recover all of it. You know, that's the kind of the bird in the hand theory. But when you inject gas back into a solid, you know, porous rock, you're not going to get it all back the second time. So there will be loss to the ultimate loss to the consumer of natural gas. That's a bad deal.
It helps your oil recovery.
That depends. That depends on the reservoir. Some reservoirs it helps recovery. Some reservoirs it would hurt recovery. It's not universal that it would help recovery. Depends on the drive mechanism in the reservoir. If you have a reservoir that does not have a strong water drive, and you need to maintain the pressure in the reservoir, and gas injection can help recovery substantially. But if you've got a strong water drive reservoir, it's more likely to cause a loss. It also depends on how long you do it.
Would it be feasible to pipe natural gas to shore from an offshore operation like that?
Sure. That's exactly what we'll do in our facility. We're going to separate oil and gas on the platform, and we'll have two lines coming to shore, one that's oil with 20% water in it, and the other one is natural gas. and we bring it to shore, and we separate out the butanes and propanes and make dry gas, and then go into a consumer gas line and have propane and butane as products of the onshore facility. But if you don't pipe it to shore, then you've got to liquefy it, you know. And that's the problem of trying to handle the gas offshore. To take it out by tankers or something, you'd have to liquefy it offshore, which would take, you know, the equivalent of 10 or 15 platforms just to get the space available to do that, and that's just completely impractical.
Are there other questions from the committee? Catherine hasn't had a chance to ask.
Yeah, how long is that phase, the development and construction stage, how long does that usually take when you have your 500 to 700 people?
This would be 1 to 2 year period.
Was that taken into account in an impact study on the stress that was put on local services in the locality?
That was considered as part of the long term, and then brought back to the 15 to 20,000. The impact would be higher. I don't know the year by year, you know, but yeah, it was taken into account, but then averaged out. So I don't know exactly what it would be during that 1 to 2 year period.
And then that's a typical figure, 500 to 700 people is the standard figure.
Well,
for
you know, it's hard to pick a standard. It's that's for a $30 million facility and an offshore platform that's going to drill 28 wells. And, you know, I suppose it would be a standard for that particular size operation and some other size that, you know, you'd have to just figure it out. I'm sure the environmental impact statement, that final environmental impact statement is about that high. And with a couple hours to work it, I worked part of the problem, but there's a lot more data in there. You know, in any of those you look at, got all these figures laid out. You know, just a matter of looking them up.
Well, I was going to address one of the major points in computing the permit is airport transportation facility construction. I wonder, is not the offshore operation that was totally helicopter supported?
A lot of them are. I wouldn't say totally. It's for the people. In the Gulf of Mexico, most of it's helicopter. In Santa Barbara, we're still trying to decide whether to use boats or helicopters for the people transport, but for the equipment transport, for drill pipe and things like that, you need boats.
What I'm trying to get at is that it would seem that airport construction would a major portion of the costs incurred in offshore development if you had to have airports. At least in the case of Yakutat, that's the largest airfield in the state of Alaska.
I see.
Category 3, 10,000 plus. How much land is the Yakutat, all the Yakutat might be needed for the further development or building new airports or postal service. It seems to me we can watch that part of the problem out so far as
well. This impact on the services onshore can be such a variable. Like Prudhoe Bay is one example. Rather than impacting any community, you know, the industry went in there and built everything themselves. The whole thing. Now that provides a tax base now for that borough, which gets an advantage of the tax base on that, but actually the borough is not supplying any significant services. They're just getting the benefits. Prudhoe Bay supplies all its own services. And it, you know, the offshore development could work that way. Or it could be spread around. But I think it's very logical that most of the people impact would be one way or the other out of Anchorage. I mean, because it is a larger city, and that's where the people are probably going to go, most of them.
Any other questions from the committee members? You don't have anything on Mr. Finn?
No.
Mr. Carp?
Mr. Taylor just mentioned this, most of the people in fact are going to be in Anchorage. I think I know that's what the draft impact study said as well. Of course, it was referring to the in fact, I assume most of the offices and so forth. But now, when it comes to supplying the pipe and all other materials that go with it for the drilling platforms and so forth, now isn't this, my understanding is this would normally be probably hauled up in the Pacific Northwest somewhere in Seattle or some sort of place. You'd be staging it somewhere close to the platform. Right. You'd be flying it into Anchorage very likely.
No, I agree with that. The equipment would be, you know, the whoever is developing whatever would have to have some staging area somewhere along the coast, and you know, they try to find one that's as close as they can to where wherever the offshore drilling's going on, right? They might have to build one. You know, they might find something available.
I'd like to come back and just wonder. I think one of the very key things Mr. Taylor said at the very beginning, he did not really document this. He made a statement. And it is, I think, one of the key points in this whole thing. And he was referring to the timing of the impact versus the timing of the tax revenues. Did you remember one of the basic thrusts of the bill, especially in its initial concept, was front-end money? I don't believe Mr. Taylor explained, for example, how this feels that the tax revenues will be simultaneous with or precede the impact instead of the way around. I'd like to point out that here's one of the reasons for my concern. Now, Valdez isn't a good comparison. I'll grant that right at the very beginning, but take one point there that in Valdez, the pipeline terminal impact caused a tremendous jump, for example, in the need for their telephone facilities. Yeah, same thing happened in Fairfax, by the way. You need to start, the best figure I have is somewhere around 18 months in advance to expand telephone facilities. That's one example. You have to expand your power supply. You have to expand your schools. All these require lead time, and yet your onshore facilities have not really started acquiring the revenues at this point that you need to in during this lead time period. And if Mr. Taylor could address that, I think it's a key issue.
Okay, I didn't say or try to prove that there wouldn't be any impacts before there were tax revenues. What I said was that no evidence has been presented that it would be the other way around. You know, I'm just saying that that's a question that hasn't been answered. I would agree that very likely there will be some impact before tax revenues from onshore facilities would be available. I would agree with something you said the other day that advanced planning is a very good idea. I think we have shown that the exploratory phase has very small impact. Most of the people involved in the exploratory phase would not live in a coastal community. That you know, they come in and out or live there temporarily. And the exploratory phase, you know, you have to go find some oil fields before you start making development plans. At the point you find oil fields and start making development plans, then I think is a good time also for the affected communities to start pre-planning on what the impacts might be during a construction or a development phase, and during the production phase. Again, I think that this problem is being addressed nationwide, and I personally think that the things that are being considered in the federal Congress are generous impact funds that they're considering. Considering the realistic probable impacts, but I'd not disagree that there will be some impacts before the taxes come in, and this might require some, you know, if there were to be an area where more schooling is required, That's because more people are moving in and building houses. Then you might have some services that need to be provided or some schools that need to be provided, which the taxes from the people that move in would eventually pay. And there might need to be some advance bonding or something to get something some of this done. And, of course, the federal impact funds are designed to help in that regard. I do think it takes advanced planning, but I think we need to look at the real cases, you know, rather than kind of numbers that don't tie together.
I think we've got just a little bit of time left, and Mr. Waring has requested three minutes of our time here, so I'm
going to... Could I ask a question or two just before you start? Just one short. The tank farm at, I guess that's what you would call it, Valdez, what's the cost of that? What's the value of that thing? Have any idea?
I have no idea. The only number I know about Valdez, I happened to be there 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I know we're spending about $2 million a year shoveling snow. That's the only number I remember.
Does anybody know what the value of that?
But I have no idea what the
anybody value. Anybody in the audience know what
the cost of the term would be? About $1 billion.
$1 billion?
Billion? That's the terminal. That isn't just the tanks. What the point I was trying to get at is that I was curious as to how many millions upon millions of dollars of property that will the municipality of Valdez will end up with as this taxable property that will require absolutely no services. It'll be like a gold mine. You don't. What kind of services do you provide to a tank farm? You don't provide schools or roads or electricity or anything else. It's just a big fat gold mine sitting there producing tax revenues. There's a point I want to make on the, you know, that all the impact that you get out of this thing is not bad.
Well, that's certainly true.
Kevin?
We had some questioning, Mr. Chairman, at hearing the other day. I just wanted to... tell you that we will be providing some information. I don't really want to engage in any protracted debate about some of this population question. We are going to provide some documentation from various sources for your own consideration, and I think from that you can make your own decision about who's perhaps crying wolf or who's crying pussycat. Included will be some information that industry itself developed and published as its own environmental assessment of the Gulf of Alaska lease sale, which by their own calculations, projects that in the first year there will be 800 additional jobs in Alaska, the second year 1,400, the third year 2,100, and a progression up to a peak of about 3,000 jobs within a few years after the lease sale. 3,000 jobs probably means about 10,000 people in one lease sale, and 10 lease sales, 9 lease sales rather, quickly builds up to something in the order of 90,000 jobs. I'd also, you know, just by way of...
4,000 jobs?
No, people.
You said jobs.
Pardon me, I meant to say people. I would note that Mr. Taylor did cite at some points the draft EIS for the Gulf of Alaska and at some points the final EIS for the Gulf of Alaska. There was a substantial change in the draft to the final figure of 115 people for Yakutat, which came under some criticism, was radically revised upward. As far as offshore California, I would refer to a final environmental impact statement prepared by the Bureau of Land Management for OCS lease sale, number 35, off Southern California, where for a level of production comparable to what is projected for the Gulf of Alaska, they foresaw approximately 6,000 jobs within a period of a few years and approximately 20,000 people generated by the OCS lease sale down there. I think, as I say, by Monday we will provide you a package of information, really a brief covering such sorts of population estimates and some of the other information on revenues and public expenditures that
I think it'd be real helpful.
Could be useful to you.
Mr. Hackney?
In the figures for California OCS,
yes.
Does that include processing onshore or is that merely shore facilities?
What they are talking about is total plans. Employment, with that directly involved. In some ways, they're talking about some facilities that will not be provided in Alaska. That is, they are assuming some fabrication of steel platforms in the neighborhood, but they're also talking about some activities that will not occur, there are activities that will occur in Alaska that will not occur down there. That is, they already do have some receiving facilities on shore that will not need to be constructed and such as that. So, you can't draw an exact comparability, sir.
Would you make every effort to sort the two out so that
when
you present us the figures, it'll be something that we'll really be able to believe in?
Well, I think even the figures that were developed by the Gulf of Alaska Operators Committee in their environmental assessment are at least in view of the trend of testimony you've heard so far, probably fairly credible to you as a minimum. And they certainly put us within the ballpark of the larger end rather than the minimal end of the population projections. What we will be providing you is a variety of projections, and I think you, by comparison, at least get some sense of what the scale of population growth might be.
We are just about adjourned. There's going to be some subsequent hearings, and if there are people that haven't testified yet, arrange with my staff assistant to we'll allow everyone that wants to testify. I had expected some administration people to be here, but apparently they're either not prepared or not able to make it. In that case, Bob, you were next on the list here. In case if you'd like. Oh, okay, so Gene Wiles, Southern
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity of being able to appear here this morning. My name is Gene Wiles, and I'm representing Standard Oil of California. By way of background, I'm an attorney, been practicing here for approximately 20 years. And I'm going to be making comments on some matters that, of economics and statistics, in which I have no background or expertise. However, I'm relying on studies that have been made by the industry, and I will try to report to you as accurately as possible the results of these studies. If you'll excuse me for just a minute, I'll get my chair out here. Basically, it's the position of Standard Oil Company of California that we do not agree with the stated purpose of the act, that there's an immediate demand for greatly increased services because of outer continental shelf activity. And this statement is based upon a study that was made by the industry by Mathematical Sciences Northwest, Inc. This is a copy of the complete study that was made by Mathematical Sciences. And basically, I'd just like to go through some of the highlights of this study to indicate what the study is about, what it encompasses, and what the results of the study were. The purpose of the study was undertaken for the Gulf of Alaska operators was to estimate the likely economic and social impact on 6 Gulf of Alaska communities as a result of the exploration for and development of petroleum resources there. The 6 communities were Juneau, Yakutat, Cordova, Whittier, Seward, and Kodiak. Basically, just to give you a sort of an overlay of what the results were. The results were that the development production activities in the Gulf of Alaska would generate new jobs directly and indirectly, both in the coastal communities and the state as a whole. The estimate given, and the assumption is on the base case, and I'll tell you what the base case is in a minute, but that direct OSC employment will number 291 persons in 1976, peak at 1,486 persons in 1980, and level off at 886 persons in 1985. There had to be a tremendous amount of assumptions made in this review because of the indefinites, and I'll just give you the list of the indefinites that they took into consideration that has to be taken into consideration in any review of this type. The intensity of the exploration activity, the proven oil and gas reserves discovered, the total quantities and rates at which oil and or gas will be produced, whether petroleum is exported in crude form or will be transformed or will be transformed prior to shipment, whether natural gas when produced will be exported from Alaska in liquid or form or will be further transferred as a petrochemical, how many coastal communities will become onshore support bases, and whether major onshore facilities will be constructed there in presently uninhabited areas, the rate at which Alaska's economy can grow in real terms in order to provide the additional goods and services demanded, the additional revenues which will accrue to local, regional, and state governments, and the increased induced demand for public services. Finally, and certainly a major importance, the determining of the types and duration of short and long-term social economic impacts on coastal communities of Alaska. Now, in reaching this, they reached an assumption. It was assumed that there would be a total of five fields that would be discovered with a peak production of 550,000 barrels a day. Two shore bases would support the offshore activities. Pipelines would be built to transport the crude to two marine terminals, and crude would be shipped to market from there. So this is basically the assumption they made, that they would the high would be 10 fields, the low would be zero, and they took the intermediate to five fields with the production of 550,000 barrels a day. Now, it's a very complete study, and basically, they concluded that there would be related jobs and support jobs, and on table I2 of the it shows the total number of jobs and that would be directly and indirectly associated with all this activity in these six major communities. In 1976, it shows that there would be a total additional population per year of 1,396. And 1977, 1623, 1978, 1636, 1979, 1430, 1980, 1147, 1981, a minus 199, 1982, a minus 1,199, and 1983, a minus 1,207. Then as in the table 2-3, shows the direct, in other words, what the direct effect would be just from the outer continental shelf. And that shows in 1976 it would be 59 people in these six communities. And this doesn't, it also includes the other areas other than these six communities, like Anchorage. 1977 would be 180. 1978, 147, 1979, 136, 1980, 176, and 1981, 71, 1982, 29, 1983, 81, 1984, 210, and 1985, 211.
Gene, can I interrupt you for just a second?
Yes.
you know, the first list of figures you gave was on the new jobs. In 1980, you showed 1,486, and then new people in all six areas. Is that what you said?
Well, what,
176 new
the,
people.
The one table, Mr. Chairman, table I2 or 22, is the direct impact plus all additional jobs that will be related there to. In other words, your support services, your increased grocery stores, whatever. It'd be the total impact on all these communities, directly and indirectly. And your table...
Is that the one you just read the figures from?
No, the one that I just read the figures one would be your direct. In other words, what would be related directly to the offshore drilling.
What about the new jobs figures over the first ones you gave? You said in 1980.
Well, these are not new jobs. These are just additional population.
The figure, for instance, you just gave 176 persons in 1980. Now,
right.
I'm having trouble relating that to the first figure you gave, 1,486 new jobs in 1980.
Well, if I said that, I'm very sorry. These are both related. These are just population. When the population increases. The first table, maybe if I just read this, it would clarify it. Certainly the new employees in secondary support sectors such as retail and wholesale trade, finance, insurance, and real estate would be included in this first one. In other words, they wouldn't be directly related to the oil industry. They would be a support industry. Those are the figures that I gave you first. The second figures are just the ones that would be additional population created directly relating to the offshore operations, the oil industry itself. And then the report is very comprehensive. It shows you the utilities that would be additionally used, solid waste, transportation, goes through air transportation, water transportation, gives the impact on that. And education gives you an overview of that. It's a very, very comprehensive report. I'm going to leave this report with you. And I think what it basically shows is that the immediate impact will be very slight, and that you're not going to have a great deal of number of employees, additional people in a community related to the offshore industry. And further, I'd like to, this is another report by Mathematical Sciences, which is a little little less detailed, but I think it's a little easier to go through it this time. They have phase one, which is the geological and geophysical study, and I don't have that. That phase is over with now. It's taking place. The sale has been made. The initial sale has been made, and most of your geological and geophysical studies have taken place. But it goes into phase two, the exploration and drilling, phase three, development, drilling, and construction, and phase four, producing. And the figures here, I think, are quite enlightening. On table one, you have the the exploratory well schedule. It gives you the year, the number of wells that will be drilled, and the number of rigs that will be employed in the drilling. 1975, there will be no drilling. They estimate in 1976 that at Yakutat, there will be 8 wells drilled, and at Patala, 4. There will be 2 rigs at Yakutat and 1 at Patala. 1977, there will be 19 wells, 4 2/10 rigs at Yakutat, and 10 wells in Patala, and so on down. And then the second sale, they estimate, will be made in 1978, and you have the same figures there. Then over on table two, they give you the type of rigs and when they'll be drilling. And also, it shows you here the personnel that will be involved on the rigs. That in 1976, when they start drilling, there'll be personnel rigs. There'll be 160 outside, and that's outside of Alaska. Alaskans 28, and those that would live locally would be 15. That would be in Yakutat. At Cordova, the figures would be, this is in the Yakutat area altogether. And then it would go up to, the figures here, just carrying it across, in 1977 it would go up to 60 people that would be live there locally. 105 in 1978, 125 in 1979, and 112 in 1980. And it carries the figures right on down to show you just exactly. And then your table 3 is on-site personnel required to operate the drilling vessel. And this gives you all your statistics on that. And this carried on. And then on table 4 is the materials required for exploration wells. And that gives you your their estimate of the materials during your phase 2, which is your exploration and drilling phase. And then the report goes into phase 3, the development, drilling, and construction. And I think some of this is I think I'll just read some of this. It says, development of this field will entail the construction and setting in place of 3 permanent producing platforms and associated facilities, and the drilling of 54 producing wells, 18 from each platform. It will also include the pipeline construction required to transport the oil to a shore base, and construction of shore base and marine terminal, which will be used to transship the crude oil to tankers for shipment to a refinery. The bar chart table 2, and this is table 2 under this section, illustrates the schedule to be followed in this assumed development. As can be seen from table 2, nearly 4 years will pass after the discovery is made before any oil is produced. The platform construction will take nearly 2 years to complete, and 2 additional years will be required to complete drilling of the wells. The local construction activity will be greatest in 1980, 3 years after the discovery well is drilled. The estimated investment required for the development is itemized in table 3. Now, table 3 indicates that there will be $555 million invested in that, in this phase of the development. The delineation wells drilled subsequent to discovery will probably be completed with the same equipment used for the exploration drilling. The wells are not likely to be used as producers, but we would drill for information only, then permanently abandoned below the sea floor. The greater part of the platform construction work will be carried out in an industrial area remote from the Gulf of Alaska, such as Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, or San Francisco. It may be feasible to use reinforced concrete for platform construction material. If this is the case, then Seward or Kodiak may be potential construction sites. The platform construction will be assembled and towed to the field location, then set in place. As can be seen from the bar chart, table 2, the on-site work will take about 3 months of the time during the calmest weather. The deck structure and facility will be assembled and in modules and installed on the platform structure within that period of time. The pipeline will be fabricated and installed during the summer months. The development wells will all be completed from the finished platforms using directional drilling techniques. By this method, all wellheads will be within the platform structure and immediately accessible, while the area drained by the wells at the producing horizon can be spread over a considerable area of the platform. uh, the construction of shore base and marine terminals will constitute the largest activity to take place in the area. The construction period is likely to be 2 years and will entail the use of up to 40 acres of coastal lands. Since sheltered ports are scarce in the area, it is quite likely that the breakwater will be constructed to protect the loading facilities. It is also likely that the shore base will be built at the nearest convenient location on the shore to minimize the very high cost of subsea pipelines.
Can I interrupt you there for
yes.
another second? Well, that last comment you made was that it would most likely any of the construction would be built at the most convenient location. What's happening right now in Yakutat? Is there plans for a shore facility right now? I mean, are there plans for such a facility at the moment? I'm not sure that SoCal's even got.
Well, that's my problem, Mr. Chairman. I'm not privy to the information that of what's taking place at Yakutat. I would assume that I don't know whether Waco's here or not. Mr. Shelley, who represents Mobil, might have those facts, but I don't. I don't have any idea what's going on over there. We didn't get any leases, and so I don't know what the other companies are doing on that.
Well, you've given us two parcels of data and information there that'll probably be very useful. And it was my understanding that the administration was to provide us with their set of facts this morning as well. But they, for one reason or another, they weren't able to deliver as you have. And I'm not going to attempt to cut you off here, but unless you got to.
I only have one copy of this report. I'd like to have that reproduced and returned. But I think the tables here, you can go through them, and basically what I'm trying to point out is here you have a very, you have a investment in this development stage of $555 million, and you have people employed that, or the impact is very negligible. In other words, what I'm pointing out is you have a very capital-intensive operation. In other words, you have the capital goes in there, and you have a tax base for the community because of these capital investments, and you have very little impact on the community. And I'll submit this, and I'd like to have it returned because I think it's very easy to read and it's very understandable, and I think it points out what I'm trying to illustrate. And I would like to say one more thing. The administration has commented on the situation down in the Kenai Peninsula, and they've indicated that there's been an increase since 1960 or 61 of some 3,600 people down there. But I'd like to point out that that the industry down there is also very capital intensive, and the people are quite satisfied with